All right. So today we're going to be looking at the first part of the Satipatthana Sutta. And I think if we were to play one of those, games where we asked each other, if you could just take maybe one or two suttas with you on a desert island, which one would it be? There's a fair chance the Satipatthana Sutta will be up there. It's referenced in the jhana meditation instructions that we just followed. And it's a really complete teaching. It may not be your favorite sutta, but I think in terms of covering almost, it's almost a sort of a dummy's guide to the Buddha's teachings, right? All in one place. So it's critical to give us sort of clarity on our practice and focus. So let's get stuck in. On one occasion, the Buddha was in Kamasadama, where he addressed those assembled. Friends, there are four frames of reference, four foundations of mindfulness that are required for the purification of all beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and regret, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for establishing the right method of practice, and for complete unbinding. What are these four? Being mindful of the breath in the body, determined and alert, and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. Being mindful of feelings arising from the sixth sense base, determined and alert, and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. Being mindful of thoughts arising from the sixth sense base, determined and alert, and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. Being mindful of the present quality of mind, determined and alert, and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. So the four foundations of mindfulness we've covered on several occasions in the past. I guess the two words that keep coming up here, or at least that stand out to me, are the mindfulness and the abandoning. And so we're going to focus a bit more today on the mindful element, the first component of this process of purification of our minds. And I think probably in the next class, we'll focus a bit more on the abandonment side of things by looking at the hindrances and how we abandon those. But I think the first thing that really stands out here is that this is a practice in which we have to be proactive. It's not just a case of, being mindful and just allow, whatever will be, let's just be mindful of it. But also you're being encouraged, once you've become mindful, to actually abandon things which are not adding or not bringing peace and calm. So, and how does one remain mindful of the breath in the body in and of itself? Finding a secluded spot, the shade of a tree or an empty hut, sitting erect with legs crossed in front, placing attention on the breath. I always like this as just a reminder. I tend to, I'm in the process of sort of moving house, and I'm looking. I've been the reason I was worried I might be late for classes because I've had all of these appointments this morning with for viewings of flats and whatnot. And I keep trying to, I can't help but, think, well, which is going to be the best, in which apartment am I most likely to get enlightened? And I'm, you know, there's, I went to one apartment and it's on top of a shopping mall. And I was like, oh, I'll never get enlightened there because there's, you know, bars and in the vicinity. And then I went to one that was right on the seafront. And I was like, okay, this is the place. This is the place. But of course, it's all a bit ridiculous, isn't it? Because as the Buddha said, as long as you can find seclusion, we don't need to buy into any kind of marketing spiel about thinking that the solution is out there. It's within us, and in the Buddha's time, it was the shade of a tree or an empty hut. And for us, it's wherever we are right now. Remaining mindful of the breath, breathe in and breathe out. Mindful of the breath, long or short, breathe in and breathe out. Training yourself to be sensitive to the breath and calming any bodily fabrication. So just this word here, two words again that that really stand out to me are training. And I like to see the practice as a training because throughout our lives, we've all trained in various things and we've got better at them, right? Presuming we practice correctly, we've gotten better at so many different things in our lives, whether it be learning how to, you know, write or read for the first time, to speaking a foreign language, to I don't know, training in Excel or whatever it might be, right? We've learned how to do things and we've got better at them. Those things that where we've put our time and our effort, we've gotten better at them. And it's interesting how with this particular type of training, it's so easy to convince ourselves that we're not making any progress or that we are but it's not worth it. And this is just the mind. Well, I mean, I think there's two things going on here. I think, first of all, it's very easy to train incorrectly. It's very easy to have a path of practice that, even if it has sincere intentions, is actually not leading us to disentanglement. So that's the first thing going on here, right? Is the training we're doing appropriate for the results that we want to see? But then the other side of it is that because this particular type of training is so caught up, or it's so vulnerable to the ego and that potential for our own egos to convince us that we're no good or we can't do it. And we can't really get vindication from someone else. So it's up to us. Nobody else knows our own mind. So it's very easy to sort of create stories for ourselves that we're not making progress or to not realize how far we've come in our practice. So, I think there is something to be said there for taking stock every so often and realizing, having an honest reflection on our practice and thinking, are we practicing correctly? If we really, really don't think we're making progress, are we not practicing correctly? But the second question is, actually, am I gaining a better mastery over my mind? Is there some evidence that I'm showing more wise restraint in my life? It could be big or small. And the second word here is calming. Which again, I think it's I like this focus on calming because it really encourages us to see our practice in a very proactive sense, right? There's the potential for the breath to calm whatever bodily fabrication we have in that moment. It's not just a case of putting up with the fact that you're anxious and thinking, well, I'll be anxious forever because I'm just anxious. There is actually the potential here for the breath to calm that feeling, and we can gain some pleasure and satisfaction from that. So continue with the Buddha's words. Ever mindful, calming the body with each breath, in breath and each out breath. Remaining mindful of the breath in the body, mindful of the in breath and the out breath, the arising and passing away phenomena with regard to the body. In this way, one remains mindful internally and externally with regards to the body. With no self-reference, calmly noticing there is a body, remaining independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. When walking, be mindful of walking. When standing, be mindful of standing. When sitting, be mindful of sitting. When lying down, be mindful of lying down. In any function, be mindful that there is a body. When going about, look this way and that. Be fully mindful. When bending or reaching, be fully mindful. When carrying a bowl or a cloak, be fully mindful. When eating, drinking, or savoring food, be fully mindful. When eliminating waste, be fully mindful. When walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, waking, talking, or silent, be fully mindful. And this, for me, is a reminder of essentially the reason why we're practicing. We're practicing not just to create some, you know, to reach the fourth jhana and to, perhaps to disappear from the world entirely. And I mean, don't get me wrong, if that fourth jhana, if and when it occurs, that's fantastic, right? But essentially, we're developing tools through our mindfulness practice that enable us to integrate this quality of mind and this peaceful approach to living in every single aspect of our lives. And so it's a reminder for us that yes, the practice may begin on the cushion, but it certainly doesn't end there. Because if we're sticking to our, you know, twice a day or however many times a day of practice, if we get off the cushion and then spend the remaining 23 hours of our day utterly ignorant of Four Noble Truths and entirely forgetting or leaving behind any experiences or progress that we will have made in our training while on the cushion, then we're not really getting the full benefit of our practice. In this way, one remains mindful of the breath in the body, the in-breath and the out-breath. In this way, one remains mindful of the breath in the body, the arising and the passing away of the body, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. Just as a person with good eyesight, emptying a bag full of mixed grains would know there is wheat, there is rice, there are beans, there are sesame seeds. In this same way, one remains mindful of from the soles of the feet to the top of the head, encased in skin, there is hair, nails, teeth, tendons, bone, marrow, organs, feces, phlegm, blood, urine, sweat, fat, tears, saliva, mucus, and fluid in the joints. Sounds pretty gross, huh? I played tennis yesterday against a friend, and he decided we had a drink after the game, and he thought he felt obliged to take his socks off and show me the kind of ingrowing toenail that he had. This awful situation with his toenail. I actually kind of feel I shouldn't describe it to you in too much detail. Although the Buddha has just done that, in all fairness. Like a just a black toenail with like bits, like some pus coming out the side, and obviously it'd been aggravated from playing tennis. I could go on, right? But then I was asked, you know, we were sort of talking a little bit sort of philosophically or whatnot. And of course, you know, I was thinking about this sutta and, you know, this sense of self, right? So we spend, you know, so long potentially grooming ourselves. I mean, I don't spend very long doing that, but some people do. Grooming ourselves, right? Because there are aspects of ourself that we want to cling to and we want to showcase to everyone else. And then there was this guy's toenail, which in all fairness to him, he was happy to show it to me, but I don't think he would have particularly wanted it to show it to someone that he actually wanted to impress. And so, you know, to what extent is that gross toenail his versus, you know, is that his self? Is he a really gross toenail? You know, or is he a, you know, the image of himself wearing, I don't know, whatever trendy clothing and all of that sort of stuff, right? So it's all a fabrication at the end of the day. And I think it's quite interesting how the Buddha, you know, sort of reminds us of how, if it wasn't for our fabrications, then our entire bodies are kind of gross in many ways, right? Anyway, in this way, one is mindful of the four elements: the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the wind element. The four elements that comprise a human being are impermanence. Be mindful of the impermanence of the body to develop this passion. If left unattended, a corpse decays quickly. It becomes bloated and infested. It is picked at by birds and dogs and other creatures. Eventually, nothing is left but dust. Be mindful that this very body, too, will die and pass away. This is the nature of the world and an unavoidable fate. Right? What are we clinging to here? Is essentially what the Buddha's asking us. In this way, one remains mindful of the breath in the body, the in-breath and the out-breath. In this way, one remains mindful of the arising and the passing away of the body, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the breath in the body. And how does one remain mindful of feelings in and of themselves? When feeling pain, be mindful that there is pain. When feeling pleasure, be mindful that there is pleasure. When feeling neither pleasure nor pain, i.e. ambivalence, be mindful that there is neither pleasure nor pain. When feeling the pain of the body, be mindful that there is the pain of the body. When feeling pain not of the body, i.e. a disturbance in the mind, be mindful that there is pain not of the body. When feeling pleasure in the body, be mindful that there is pleasure in the body. When feeling pleasure not in the body, i.e. an excitement in the mind, be mindful that there is pleasure not in the mind. When feeling neither pleasure nor pain in the body, be mindful that there is neither pleasure nor pain in the body. When feeling neither pleasure nor pain in the body, be mindful that there is neither pleasure nor pain not in the body, excuse me. In this way, one remains mindful of feelings and the arising and the passing away of feelings, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. In this way, one remains mindful internally and externally with regard to feelings. This is how one remains mindful of feelings in and of themselves. So I think we're sort of quite well versed in knowing that when we are feeling pleasures of pain, we should not cling to them and let them go. I'm not saying it's easy. I mean, it is easy. It's not that hard, but we convince ourselves it's not easy. Let's put it that way. I find it a bit more deceptive when there's feelings of pleasure. Because it's kind of like you don't want to get rid of the pleasure. You kind of want to see an end to the pain. because, you know, who wants pain? Whereas, you know, when you, again, just coming back to my little situation this morning when I was seeing all of these apartments, there was one I really liked and I was leaving there suddenly kind of getting excited. Oh, I think this is the one I'm going to go and live in, and et cetera, et cetera. And so it's easy to get wrapped up in that. And then remember that even that you need to be mindful of, because who knows, I might make an offer and it might be rejected. Well, clearly it's not going to live up to all of my expectations if I have super high expectations, because that's just not the way life works. But it's even more important to remind yourself, I think, of to not get carried away too much on the pleasure side, because it's easier to forget, I find at least, than reminding yourself to be mindful of pain. But of course they both need to be taken into account. Okay. I'm just going to go through a bit of text from John. Okay. Mindfulness of thoughts. And how does one remain mindful of thoughts in and of themselves? When thoughts are passionate, be mindful that thoughts are passionate. When thoughts are dispassionate, be mindful that thoughts are dispassionate. When there are thoughts of aversion, be mindful that there are thoughts of aversion. When there are thoughts free of aversion, be mindful that there are thoughts free of aversion. When thoughts are deluded, be mindful that thoughts are deluded. When thoughts are free of delusion, be mindful that thoughts are free of delusion. How does one know? I think this is John's words, actually. How does one know delusion? Thoughts and actions that contradict the Eightfold Path are deluded. So again, this is the limiting nature of the Dharma. Back to the Buddha's words. When the mind is constricted, be mindful that the mind is constricted. When thoughts are scattered, be mindful that thoughts are scattered. When the mind is spacious, be mindful that the mind is spacious. When thoughts are common, be mindful that thoughts are common. When thoughts are unsurpassed, be mindful that thoughts are unsurpassed. When the mind is not concentrated, be mindful that the mind is not concentrated. When the mind is concentrated, be mindful that the mind is concentrated. When the mind is released, be mindful that the mind is released. When the mind is released, when the mind is not released, be mindful that the mind is not released. When the mind is released, be mindful that the mind is released. In this way, one remains mindful internally and externally with regard to thoughts. So I think it's important that we, having gone through this part of the Satipatthana Sutta, we're going to discover the next part of the sutta in the next class, because it doesn't stop with just being mindful of, you know, it's not just like, oh, my mind's not concentrated. Oh, well, you know, of course, that's the beginning of it, right? Is to accept where your mind state currently is. But I think the abandoning part that I referenced at the beginning and that we'll be looking at by looking at the hindrances in the next session is really important, because there's something you can do about it, right? You can realize that your mind is constricted or whatever it might be, not concentrated, deluded. But it's if you just keep noticing that your mind's deluded and you never do anything about it being deluded, then, you know, you're not making as quick a progress, I think, as you can if you really abandon abandon the fetters, abandon the obstacles to you having a peaceful and calm mind, which we'll come to in more detail next on Tuesday, I guess. Okay. And I think we're almost done. Finally, the present quality of mind. And how does one remain mindful of the present quality of mind in and of itself? One remains focused on the mind internally or externally, on the mind itself. One remains focused on the origination of the mind and the arising and the passing away with regard to the mind itself. One knows there is a mind. They remain independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of thoughts in and of themselves. And I think that's where we leave it for this class. Yeah, I think that's it. So thanks everyone for listening. Let's go around the room, starting with our virtual room. Tracy, I know I as I mentioned at the beginning, you've had a double take on the first part of the Satipatthana Sutta. But how did the second time round, what resonated with you second time round?
I'm grateful for the second time around. As always, timing seems to be everything. The first time I heard it, I guess it was last week, at the stage that I was at in my practice, some of it got through, some of it didn't. Interestingly enough, this morning I went to sit when I got up in the morning, and I set the intention for the first time ever, if you could believe it, even though it's been drilled into us verbally for, at least for me anyway, now almost 2 years, but I set the intention to think of this as a skill, and like that the breath is a tool to cessation, not to simply just endure the arising and passing away of feelings and thoughts and bodily sensations. And, you know, and yes, like I think just like any other skill, you can muddle your way through something and come out with something at the end of it. And then, of course, you're not getting the full picture. Right. Like I'm thinking of other things like that. Right. Like another example in my life would be like running. Like on the surface, it seems like anybody could just go outside and run, but you're going to get hurt. It looks simple, right? You just go, right? You're going to be out of breath. You're going to be struggling. You're just trying to get to the end of it so that you can go lay down and watch television, right? Like that's how I would run in the past, and I would set these big goals, you know, I'm gonna run a marathon. Meanwhile, I'm like, I have no game plan whatsoever. And did I get a little bit better in shape? Yeah. Did I for a little while? Was I able to, you know, run a little longer, a little faster? Sure, but I gave up on it. And I think like what I'm starting to realize is like just like something like running that seems simple. It isn't. Like it requires, and this is the thing that came to mind as you were going through this sutta, which, you know, is also quite long and very instructional. It's like you need, not you, but I believe I'm starting to realize that in order to really do this, you have to be alert and ardent, right? And I think, at least for me anyway, like over the years of different practices that I've done, and this idea that meditation is supposed to be relaxing, and then it's not, and then you're like pissed off about it, you know? I'm realizing now that that is, you know, the goal is not relaxation. The goal is understanding. And in my sit this morning, I was able to do this well. And then your teaching this morning really was very clear, like a bell for me, like, yes, 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 yes. So second time around, very good. Thank you.
I love the sort of running anecdote, so to speak, is really, really helpful here, because if you were to take up running with the pure objective of, I don't know, losing weight or even completing a race, and you only saw the benefit at the end on the finishing line, you aren't going to keep it up. Even if you manage to lose weight, right? You're not going to, you know, as soon as you lose that weight or whatever it might be, whatever your objective is, you're going to then be like, well, yeah, but I didn't really enjoy it. I achieved my, whatever that goal was. And I think with meditation and with the Dharma, it's that plus some, because not only if you're transfixed on the end goal, you're not going to enjoy the process. So you're never going to get that runner's high, let's imagine, right? That you get, which does happen with people that start running. Eventually they start to actually enjoy it, which can happen in meditation as well. But also in compared to running, it's even more com I mean, it's more difficult to do it in terms of future goals, because the goal itself is not, there is no finish line. Unlike you can't measure your practice on scales or by a fi finish line, right? It can never really be measured in that sense. And so yeah, you have to that idea of really in understanding, right? Which, as you said, is the purpose. You understand, and so you know then how to live your life better. But enjoying that process of understanding, right? I think if you can get those two things, then suddenly your practice becomes sort of self-encouraging, and then everything else sort of falls away. Yeah, but thanks so much for sharing that.
Thank you.
Useful, very useful anecdote, I think, for or anecdote's not, what's the word I'm looking for? Anyway, you know what I mean. Useful example for us all to reflect on. Okay,
Thank
let's
you.
go around the room. Now, this incidentally, the Zoom thing on it sort of, it almost gets me dizzy looking at the screen, because it randomly shoots from one side of the room to the other with no warning. Like I'll suddenly get a close up of Zach's forehead or something like that. And you know,
Right.
nothing wrong with that.
Let me turn that off.
Only if you can, I think it's just, yeah. I don't think it adds much value.
No.
That's just me.
So I'll be the
Okay, yeah, you can sort of delegate, Ram.
your view is good enough. You can see the people.
Perfect.
Okay.
Yep. Zach, I think you're in the firing line, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I'll keep it brief. I just, as you mentioned, all of the activities of standing, sitting, whatevering. Just pretty sure you don't have a phone in your hand when you're doing that. Because that is the world. That is constant entanglement with the world.
Yeah.
Everything is there. And just driving yesterday, by myself for just a few minutes and at a stoplight and just noticing the urge to pick up the phone and look at the emails and not doing it, but just appreciating that urge to be distracted or entangled.
Can I ask you a question? I'm just curious, because what you shared a few weeks ago resonated with me a lot. You were sort of feeling quite entangled in your work, and that was a bit of a challenge with your practice. How the last few weeks been on that front?
Good in some regards, challenging in others, but think some of the times that are most challenging are actually the times when there is not something to occupy my attention. And noticing that and letting the good work that I've done manifest or not manifest. And being okay with not working while those things either come to fruition or don't. But,
Mm.
I've got enough irons in the fire. Think a high degree of confidence. And if I overdo it during the lull, very likely, which is what happened last time, when these things start to actually bubble up and come to fruition, it'll be too much. So being okay, much with like sitting at the light and not picking up the phone. Just when I've got a day that seems like it's fairly well, there's just not a lot going on from a work perspective, just letting that be and taking, the time to meditate and investigate the Dhamma and take walks and be present.
Thanks, Zach. I think we're going to the back now. Sangamam, Becky.
Hi, Tom. Always nice to see you. Thank you for the teaching. I spent a lot of time while you were talking, sort of investigating my understanding. And I feel like there's things that I still struggle with even after all this time. And I don't think I'm going to be able to really put them into words, but I feel quite calm a lot of the time during my day. And I don't have outside, I'm not out in the world like all of you are. So a lot of my struggle is in my own mind and reacting to, small things that happen in my own day. But this past couple of days, we spent time with people that we've been friends with for many years, and they are having some really difficult, they're going through some difficult times because we're all older and things are happening to them that we all fear are going to happen. Just some losing of faculties, not bad, but progressive. And it was very, yeah, I don't know, it was so interesting to just see how I reacted, not reacted, but how I dealt with this. And it was like there wasn't a lot I had to say or I could do because this is what was happening. And if I was going to use right speech, there was not a lot to say. There was not a lot to say. And I felt myself sort of filling in spaces by bringing up mundane, conversations. And I didn't, I was like, am I practicing the Dhamma right now? Or am I just trying to make myself feel better in this situation? What is happening? So when you went through all of those, the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the whole ball of wax, I just started thinking, well, was I doing this? Was I doing this? Was I abandoning? Was I clinging? And now I'm just completely confused. So that's all I have to say.
Last question. You
Yes.
started off saying you had difficulties and you went right into what your practice is. Exactly what you're supposed to be doing, seeing it arise and pass away. So you start off with, I had all these difficulties. I'm not doing it right. Is it working? What are you experiencing that you're having difficulties with? Because you really did go right into a practice. That is a perfect description
Maybe
of our practice.
I'm clinging and craving for the practice to be more magical.
How much better can you have that situation where you showed restraint, you showed it arising and passing away and not needing it to be any different, knowing that it's not maybe possibly as great as you think it should be, but it is what it is, and you didn't react right. to it. You caused no second arrow. You absolutely practiced. And does it look perfect all the time? Maybe not, but maybe expectations need to be that this is simply keeps you in this moment to be part of it. Zach was able to do the same thing. Maybe expectations are too high for what you think is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, David.
I just want to know what you were really having difficulty with.
Where's the difficulty part? We're not hearing
that. I don't know.
You had a terrible introduction and you went into a perfect explanation.
I don't know.
Did you expect to be more helpful to those friends?
Yeah, maybe I did. Maybe
you described.
Maybe I was fighting with my desire to make everything okay with them, and knowing that I couldn't do it.
Perfect.
And wondering if I should keep being present, or maybe I should try to do it. No.
And you still didn't.
You still did. I still had wise restraint. I had wise restraint.
You were describing the first noble truth.
Yeah.
That people are aging, getting sick, deteriorating, and dying.
Yes.
Take yourself out of that. It's still happening. And again, you're not participating in the second arrow.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make that loss any easier.
Less. Yeah.
But it puts it in perspective where, like, this is my role in this moment. And usually people are overreacting and make it more painful. Mm-hmm. And usually probably saying something that doesn't help the other person. How can you help somebody that's having difficulties like that?
Right. Well, thank you all.
Yeah, and to bring it into your practice right here and right now, right? So also not to get too caught up in over analyzing what you could possibly have done slightly better or whatever in the past. Whether or not it was skillful, you know, or maybe most probably it was partially skillful and maybe there was a little bit of unskillfulness there somewhere. It doesn't matter because it's gone. But then how can you now with the wisdom you have right now, based on, you know, based on the teachings and based on your current quality of mind, how do you apply that in this moment? And you have all opportunities.
Yeah, I can look back on this now that I've had it. You guys helped me really clarify it. And I can realize that I was so calm during this entire visit, more calm than I ever have been for any, really. And I think that was, I must have just been present for a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And maybe the variation that you're talking about is I was present, was I sensitive as each moment was arising?
Yeah.
And that's what Tom was talking about.
Right.
Be sensitive.
Don't go back.
That's the degree of your refined mindfulness. It will keep getting better. And things that you think you have to abandon, that ill will. No, it'll just fall away because your practice is supporting this whole thing that you put in all this effort, this right effort.
Okay, I think I took enough time now.
No, plenty of time.
Okay, thank you. Ron, would you mind moving that? There you go. So who wants to go for it?
Can you go, Mark?
Sure. Thank you for your teaching. Very good. Just going to reflect a little bit on Becky's comments and what happened also. To me this week. So my mother has passed this week, and I've watched her over the last years, go through the process of deteriorating, body and mind. And I've watched my mother fighting the deterioration of the mind. She would say something, I told you to do this, or she would always confuse things, and I try to correct it. No, that's not what happened. That's not. And having this practice now, I realized that I should have helped her be more at peace with those losses, be more accepting, you know. And very late in the game, she probably started accepting things. That's that. Want to reflect on, but also I think, Becky, it's the thing that Tom talked about watching it live. I think for me the key thing is to. Yeah, we can say our mind is, it's not this or that or the other thing, or the other qualifiers, but it's that key moment of stopping and reminding oneself to watch the mind. I think that's, at least for me, is the beginning of being able to reflect on my thoughts. If I just let my thoughts take me away, then that's, I'm not practicing. But if I manage to stop and say, okay, watch it, what is it doing? Then I'm having to, I'm practicing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a key moment for me.
Can I ask you a question? In this process of watching your mother not accept and then accept her own deteriorating mind, where was your acceptance of the situation? How did that play into that?
Oh yeah, I fought it for a long time too. I would get into arguments with her. I was like, no, that's not what happened. Mm-hmm. These are the facts.
Right.
And you just completely messing it up. That's not what happened.
Right.
But I would, I'm talking about things that happened 30, 40 years ago, and I'm pretty good with chronology of things, and she's just like all over the place, completely reshuffling the game of the past. No, Mom, that's not what happened. And I just always fought it. These are not the facts. And then finally I realized, no, it's you need to accept. There's no point. It's not about being right.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is where, again, this is where the practice
helps.
Really helps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I so want to be freaking right. Just I know I am.
Yeah. Okay.
You have to catch yourself doing this, right?
Yeah.
I find, too, that in the situation that I was in this past couple of days, that, and sometimes, sometimes I am concerned that this is ego, is that because of the practice, you can see other people sticking in the second arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a desire to intervene there, but you can't do that either unless you can.
That becomes your own second arrow.
That's okay. Right. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, when you. Because I used to do that a lot. I'd watch people just cause their own suffering, and it would get me angry. And it's like, oh, and then it took me another 6 months to finally realize I'm doing the same thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But is it an odd place to try to help people and say, look, I'm going to, use very plain language, said, look, your mind is going. You have to accept it.
It's not our place.
Yeah. It's not.
No, as far as you being in your practice, It's not your place. It's your place to see where you're sticking this second arrow. That's really it. If in that process you hit on that rare moment where somebody is actually going to hear particular teaching, great.
But then you also have to make sure that you have established the proper time to have that conversation.
Yep.
That's the sutta that Matt went over on Right Speech a few classes ago. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the name of the sutta, but it lays out all the circumstances under which these things have to align before speech is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And what's significant about that sutta that Jen's referencing to it ties in kind of beautifully to what you were saying, Tom, is that even if things are true, beneficial, actual, and even endearing, but we still have to have, according to the Buddha, the proper sense of timing. And I'm just saying this for myself because I violate this all the time. So.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, thank you.
Since that's a long list, think in terms of right intention.
Yes,
right intention, is it goodwill? Is it harmless? Are you causing harm? So that will dictate your right speech. And, you know, keep that whole list of things that, you know, the scenarios in your head is probably unlikely, but right intention will propel you into that. Which you want to be right. Is that helping her? Probably not.
No.
Right?
Never is.
Yeah.
And also compassion in the moment will help.
Yes.
To put yourself in that other person's place for an instant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That will lead you to
cause no harm.
What kind of speech or non-speech.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll just take two more minutes on to reflect on what Tracy said. Just to paraphrase what she said, it's not the end goal; it's the journey, right?
Mm-hmm.
Always nice to have a catchphrase. And be proactive. I like that. I really. Like being proactive, that's just watch your mind. What is it doing?
And I think, just quickly on that, I previously would see right effort as, you know, number of minutes I spend on the cushion and other things. But when you were just mentioning a moment ago, that moment that you notice, right, that's your opportunity. When you get caught up in some kind of deluded thinking or whatever it might be, that moment you notice, that is the moment to then show right effort and to, you know, abandon it. So you don't just notice it and be like, oh, I'm caught in delusion, but then you can actually show right effort and abandon it and uproot that, whatever it is that's causing disquiet in the mind. So it's really in that sense proactive, I think. And I think sometimes mindfulness can get a reputation of just being a bit passive and you just let everything go and, you know, live in the moment. But in reality, of course, we do have these hindrances that come up that make that difficult. And I think just the examples that we've been discussing as we go around the room are helping to sort of illuminate that a little bit. We all have our own, you know, challenges that come up, right? That make it difficult to just be mindful and that's it. So I think that's where the proactivity comes in.
Someone said about measure, I think you said that, but you know, this, how do we know we're making progress? And so we all, I think, can come up with those measuring sticks. I mean, for myself, I noticed that I've become less reactive. You know, if somebody said something in the past that, you know, rubbed me the wrong way, I'd could have been more reactive. I would just be snap right back, you know, and now I'm less, not that it doesn't happen, but I'm less reactive, I've noticed.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to have those, you know, KPIs.
For oneself. Yeah, just to check you're on track, right?
You know, yeah.
Without taking it personally. Yeah. I think you should be able to see some fruits of your practice.
Yeah.
Without personalizing everything and overanalyzing everything. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Is there someone behind you, Jen? I'm not sure. Oh,
Raquel.
Raquel.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Me, yeah. Me, petite, has its advantages because now I can hide right behind you. thank you so much for the teaching. I been listening to what you, everybody's saying, what you mentioned about the practice. As imperfect my practice is, it still has helped me a lot to be more centered, or at least to know where I am in terms of when I'm overreacting or bringing that second, the second
arrow.
And like yesterday, you know, with this past events and with my mother-in-law passing and other things in my family, because I have a big family, so I have lots of dramas and stuff to go through all the time. So I found myself being angry, and I knew I was angry, and I couldn't control that, and I was just watching my mind, and I said, I couldn't stop. It feels like I was going to this the ego thing, that the ego saying it's so comfortable to be there, being angry. Yes, you know, I'm clinging to this now, and I'm angry, and I'm overreacting to things, and it's feels almost good, and it's, you know, that okay, I can't. Ugh. You know, and I would tell her, I would tell, you know, tell Mark some things that, like, you know. And I went for a walk, and I said, let me do this, try to do this mindful walking. And my sister called and was like, oh, God. And we start having this argument about nothing. And I knew I shouldn't do it, but. And then, you know, going back home and talking with Mark and still being angry, he told me, you're not practicing. So I said, okay. Finally, I was able to calm down. I was trying to see how things are in your brain. And the frustration, you say, oh my gosh, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. But but it's short-lived now, because before I would be angry for days, forever, I guess. But now it's short-lived, and I'm able to go back into. Yesterday I was reading the John's book in preparation for this class. It was not as good as it should be, but it was a beginning in practice. I know that I need to practice. I know that I need to set that intention and do it, and that's the way. And I'm so grateful for you all to help me with this process.
Yeah, and this is a good example of the section of the Satipatthana where it says, be mindful of feelings arising and passing away. Mm-hmm. And you did both.
Right. Yeah, and also you notice that when you cling to a feeling, frustration or anger, that it stays with you, and it morphs into all of these other stories and fabrications. So we're angry for whatever the original event was, then you're angry at Mark, then you're angry at your sister, like it's all just you clinging to that anger.
you know, and feeling the anger and wanting to just stay with the anger, clinging, grieving for the anger, seeing that in your own mind is very valuable, because then that's when you it starts to change. And you recognize impermanence. I can just let anger pass away. And now you're not an angry person. You know?
Doesn't mean you'll never be angry again.
Sure.
But that's the
process. You'll be less likely to cling to anger.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
The change is possible, right?
Change is possible. You can change your mind.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing. And
Bridget,
is it Julia?
Bridget.
Bridget, sorry, Bridget, my mistake.
Thank you for the teaching, Tom. I'm gonna try not to babble, but I have like a lot of thoughts coming up with this, and I think what's coming through is just that, like in my practice so far, it's felt like imagine you're like practicing tennis, right, and the machine like spits out a ball. And I'm like conscious. I'm like, okay, mindfulness, right intention. I got this. Line it up, hit the ball. Okay, that one went a little wonky. And then the last couple of months, it's like somebody put that machine on high. And, you know, I'm just like in this situation, I have no control, like very little influence. And just, it's temporary. So that's cool. And I'm like, that's my mantra, it's temporary. But the balls are coming so quick, and I'm losing focus on my practice. Mm. And I'm thinking, do I even have a practice anymore? But I think from listening today, I'm thinking, I do have a practice. Mm. I'm just not enjoying it as much as I enjoyed the slow, you know, one ball. Oh, good, look, I'm making progress. Oh, this is nice, I'm scoring. And now it's messy because life is messy and those first arrows are coming. And sometimes there's a second arrow. And I'm doing it really quick, so it's not feeling great. But I'm like, yeah, I am actually saying, okay, that's a second arrow. Okay, you're taking that personally. And there's these very, very few moments.
Hmm.
When I can look at this situation, I feel so personal.
Mm-hmm.
I want to take it so personal. But there are a couple of moments where I'm able to say, even this is a personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually able to feel empathy for this person that's carrying a lot of harm intentionally to me. I think that I wouldn't be able to do that if it wasn't for this. Like at all. And I think just realizing, okay, that may not be 20 minute sits every day, twice a day, but that's still a practice. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I cried. Thank you for listening.
So, Bridget, what you described was what Tom was describing. It's the process. Sometimes the tennis balls are going way too fast, but you're in this process and you're not supposed to catch every ball, or hit every ball back. You're supposed to be aware of the ball and it's going to pass. That may be a little extra metaphor
there. Not taking personally, whether or not you hit the ball.
But the more important thing is that you maintain your practice and it's there to develop and it's not the end point. It's the process. And it's not always pretty. It's not always super effective. And when it does happen that it's effective, it's awesome. But you don't abandon it because it doesn't give you instant relief or changing someone who will understand that she was wrong at the moment. Or this dude is hurting me and my family. It's the process. And that's the gentleness of the practice that it allows you to know that point right there, that it's the process. So.
And I think that sense of as much as possible, especially in difficult times, having a sort of a can-do attitude, that you can do this, because you've already done it. You've done it with slower tennis balls, and now some really fast ones have come and you haven't been able to respond to all of them. But, you know, it's almost like you've suddenly gone up a level, but you won't always be at that. You know, the tennis balls will come across slower again. And eventually you'll get better at even hitting. I love the fact we're using a tennis in it. I love tennis, and I know probably most people don't love tennis as much as I do. So I appreciate, Bridget, the fact that you've chosen a tennis analogy. But, you know, you will get better at gradually hitting faster balls. That's just the way practice works in anything. And so if you can maintain, particularly in the really difficult times, that sense of can do, like, I can do this because I've learned other skills and this is another skill I'm learning, possibly the most important skill we will ever learn as human beings. And that very few people are fortunate enough even to be aware of its importance. So at least it will, you know, even if you, yeah, miss a few balls, we've all been there. I certainly have. Thank you for sharing.
Every single day that I came to class for an entire year, I cried in class. So your tears are what is occurring, and none of us are taking that person.
Yeah. John created a sangha in which, crying is actively encouraged, I feel. And trust me, that's coming from a Brit that rarely cries. I think my only tears I've shed in the last few years have been in this sangha. So
I remember that time.
Oh, I do too. Yep. Remember when you cried?
Oh yeah.
I remember the comment. I love that comment. Everybody went around in a circle and everybody spoke and cried. And then Tom was like, well, I'm not going to cry because I'm British. That was my favorite, Tom. That was so good.
No, thank you for sharing.
Thank you so much, Tom. I just take noble silence. Thank you, so much for your compassion and sympathy. It's, like Tracy was saying, it's not easy to have this practice. It's not always relaxing. So, yeah, to what Bridget's going through, and all of us, just thank you for your compassion. So.
Thank you.
Should I go?
I'm all set, Tom. Thank you.
I got something to say. You want to go?
Yeah, no.
Okay. love the Satipatthana Sutta. It is, like you said, a manual. And it is how to practice. And I think there's a lot to develop that is laid out in the sutta. So, and all of that development happens on the cushion that you then carry into the rest of your life. So on the cushion, you develop the ability to stay with your breath arising and passing away. And then you are capable of also simultaneously noticing your feelings arising and passing away, simultaneously also noticing your thoughts arising and passing away, also noticing the body and all of its phenomena arising and passing away. Also holding in mind all the factors of mindfulness, which is the second half, two-thirds of the sutta, the hindrances and the factors of awakening, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. That's a lot to hold in mind. And to develop the capacity to do that takes
practice. You know, that's like training for a marathon.
Mm.
So when we sit, we see, wow, I can stay with my breath. I couldn't do that yesterday. Or I can stay with my breath for 30 seconds before getting distracted. Well, wow, I understand what that means, that I can stay with my breath and also notice my thoughts and also observe a hindrance. So that is what, you know, I'm reminded of by listening to the sutta. And then the other part that I kind of, that kind of really hit me was, what it would be like to go through my day holding in mind just that there is a body and that all of the phenomena within that, bringing that into my mind throughout my day. You know, I can bring into my mind my feelings and my thoughts and my breath, but bringing into mind like just the being present with my body, all of its parts. Even that, you know, I feel like would be so much mental real estate that would kind of like move out all the other garbage that's in there. That, you know, I notice that I see in my, through my day, like, wow, my mind is distracted right now. But then that's it. It's like my mind's distracted. And then it's like, well, I'm just going to have to wait for that to pass away. Well, do I? Or maybe I could bring all of this. I could take all that and go, wait, let me bring all this in. Let me think about this instead. Mm. Instead of what I'm going to make for dinner and whether or not, you know, I need to sort out that conversation that I had or how many emails I sent today, how many more I need to send tomorrow. You know, like just all the garbage that gets in there as you're like driving home from work or whatever. Just like bring this in. It's like what I can think about instead of everything.
I had a literally very quick anecdote, something that struck me. On Monday morning, I had a call at 8 a.m. with it was a sales call, basically. And then we made a big sale. And then we got off a call at 9 a.m. And then me and my colleague were kind of celebrating, great deal, blah, blah, blah. And at about 9:15, she went on another call and she said, oh, my God, somebody wants to sue us. And so I went from this like, you know, extreme high to suddenly, oh my goodness, catastrophizing, we're going to be sued. And then I was able, because I had just meditated early that morning and I had read some suttas over the weekend, to realize that actually in that moment, nothing had changed in my direct environment.
Exactly.
I had a cup of tea, which is, you know, important. I was breathing air. I was sat in a room. It was raining outside, but I was sheltered. Nothing had actually changed apart from my mind state, my quality of mind, which had suddenly been taken from this high to this low. And, you know, and it was actually incredibly helpful to realize nothing's changed and something will happen. We might get the sale in the end. We might get sued. Hopefully we're not going to get sued, by the way. So, you know, I spoke to a lawyer later in the week and they were like, I don't think that's going to happen. Like it's a bit of a ridiculous thing, situation, which I won't bore you with details of, but it was just interesting how just bringing back to what you said, we have that choice in that moment to either continue to catastrophize or to choose to pay attention to something else.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It may not have changed that much.
And that's the abandonment.
Yes.
Yeah. In my head, like initially abandonment was like, it was like a pushing or like getting rid of or like making stop. And really it's actually thinking about this instead.
Yeah.
It's changing your mind.
Yeah. Because literally abandoning is walking away from something.
Right. Right.
Leaving it behind.
Yeah.
And just being aware of everything that everyone's talking about, you're experiencing a hindrance arise.
Yeah.
Ill will, restlessness,
anxiety,
doubt.
Yeah.
And then it's passing.
Mm.
and oftentimes without any involvement of you.
Yeah.
It's going to pass. And if Tom gets sued, he will react skillfully, mm-hmm. and it'll either be positive or negative. But his reaction is his control.
Yeah.
And the next time he makes a big sale, he's going to react appropriately too.
I might get
going to the later. Hoisting a few. Yeah.
And that's the great insight. Your insight into impermanence. That this is not me. It's not what makes me this thing. And that's what becoming is. Becoming is all about when you decide that is me. That is everything that is reflective of what I am. And if you're that point, you will suffer.
Yeah.
Practice allows you to make those little choices.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Let's finish with some...
Ram.
I'm good.
Oh, sorry.
I'm good. No, don't worry.
Hey, Ram.
I've had my licks in. Thank you.
Okay, let's finish with some metta. So this is what is done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. They are able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. They remain unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. They are peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. They do not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. They are always mindful that all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. They are always mindful to not deceive another or despise any being in any state. They abandon anger and ill will with ease, never wishing harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart, the wise disciple cherishes all living beings. They radiate kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, they maintain refined mindfulness. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, having completed the path, does not give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance of four noble truths. Thanks, everyone. Have a wonderful
time.